there. You're listening to The Minefield once more on RN Summer. It's wonderful to have your company. Today, we're going to go back and look at one of the big issues, I would say, of the year. It was a big issue domestically, but it was also a very, very big issue internationally. And before it got to, well, I suppose, the high point of its urgency, we had a conversation with a Pakistani writer by the name of Mohsen Hamid that tried to look at this more deeply philosophically, perhaps as a presage of what was to come. We are talking today about the role of strong borders, but in an era of mass displacement. These are not two things that go together very well. They sit in deep and profound contradiction. And so there is a lot there to mine. That's what we're going to attempt to do today. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host.
Yeah, we have seen quite a lot of times this year, haven't we, Waleed, where moral principle, kind of undeniable moral principle, comes hard up against sheer political reality. And it seems to me that strong borders in the face of this tide of stateless people, this really is in many ways symptomatic of a whole lot of problems we face today. But this is the specific question we looked at in this program. But first, here's a bit of a reminder of the scale of the disaster that so many of us were confronted with earlier this year.
It's been described as the world's deadliest border. But even after last month, when the Mediterranean saw its worst maritime disaster in decades, thousands of refugees are still fleeing some of Africa's poorest and most war-torn countries. About 5,800 people have been rescued off the coast of Libya in just 2 days. Amina Ahmad was one of them.
We are suffering. Can't you see? Look at. We are risking our life. Now that maybe we are happy being like this. We are suffering. Can't you see? We are suffering.
Sadly, that's the kind of distress that you probably hear before we segue into, the sports report of our bulletin. It's becoming all too common. And Scott, I want to propose an idea here. That I think kind of anchors the discussion we're about to have, and that is that we are right now caught in the middle of a paradox. We have a world that is becoming increasingly globalised with increasing human movement, both forced and otherwise, and yet we have a world that is, it seems, more and more determined than ever when it comes to people movement to erect impenetrable borders. Mm. And that something has to give. There is only violence, really, in that paradox. Violence for someone. It becomes then a question of exactly who pays the violence or who suffers the violence. And that naturally raises a series of questions of what is the rationale or what are the series of rationales that we use to try to erect these borders in a time that is of its own nature and its own momentum becoming increasingly borderless. Where do you want to start here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's probably worthwhile pointing out that in some respects, we've been here before. I mean, just recall that so much of the great sort of moral wrestling that dominated the post-World War II period really was predicated by this experience of mass displacement and the idea that, well, if the state cannot guarantee certain protections, certain basic rights, certain basic dignities of human beings and human communities, then there really needs to be some kind of universal understanding that gives people protection outside of the boundaries of the state. And that's what gave birth to the entire sort of regime of human rights discourse. But I think one of the things that's interesting in our time, Waleed, is that whereas immediately following, say, September 11th, much of the rhetoric surrounding how to respond to, call it what you will, mass forced migration, illegal migration, one of the way that was most commonly used to talk about how we stem that tide was barely, baldly, national security. We don't know what these people are bearing with them. And
right,
therefore,
I can't guarantee that these people are not going to be terrorists, and therefore we have to be very careful about who we let in, and we decide who comes into this country, the circumstances in which they come. That whole line of rhetoric which reconstructs asylum seekers as security threat.
That's exactly right. But I think, isn't it interesting that over the last 5 years in particular, especially as we've been seeing increased examples of the desperation of people making their way to various affluent nations, the mass casualties at sea, somehow the whole national security rhetoric simply didn't cut it. It simply jarred too much, I suppose, with our innate moral sensibilities. And so there is a kind of humanitarian overreaction overlay onto that. In other words, we are fundamentally, yes, we're trying to prevent people from landing on shores, but ultimately it's for their own good. There's a humanitarian justification. We're trying to save people from themselves.
I find that intensely interesting. I think in Australia that change probably came with the Rudd government, because I think there was a really interesting shift. Kevin Rudd stopped talking about asylum seekers as being bad people, which is partly what the Children Overboard affair was kind of doing, and started talking about people smugglers as bad people. They were the spawn of the devil. They belonged in hell. And so the focus shifted. And then you had the coalition here trying to say that, well, what we have is a problem where we don't want to outsource our refugee policy to countries that are not signatories to the Refugee Convention, which is what the Malaysia Solution controversy was about. So there was kind of a moral humanitarian underpinning to the discourse, even as the policy got more and more brutal. And I wonder how those different rationales play. In Australia, it's become humanitarian, having veered off the national security line. In Europe, it's a different sort of a situation, again, because there is a national security overlay of proximity to North Africa and Libya particularly being part of that. Mm. And then the situation with the Rohingya, which it seems may now be at least beginning to be solved by Malaysia and Indonesia and Thailand and the Philippines. Again, there are different sorts of rationales there. So there's a lot to tease out. We'll see what we can do. We'll do our very, very best to try to do that. You are on The Minefield. You can tweet us at RN The Minefield.
Yes, well, our guest today is a very distinguished guest indeed. It's Mohsin Hamid. Most people may well know Mohsin as the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, an award-winning novel. I should say, by the way, my own personal favourite novel of his is How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, a modern masterpiece, it seems to me. And he's very graciously joined us here on the program. Welcome, Mohsin.
Thank you.
Let me put the first question to you. I mean, you've written quite beautifully, eloquently about migration, but you've actually deepened the whole issue for me. Let me just read you something that you yourself have written. You say, "I believe in the human right to migration, as fundamental as the right to freedom of expression or freedom from discrimination on the grounds of gender, race, religion, or sexuality." Now, that is a very deep statement of moral openness. Make your case. How can you say that?
Well, I think that it's the existence of the countries that we live in and these borders that we abide by. These are human-made constructs. Birds move and animals move across them, and human beings once moved across them. You know, people didn't evolve in Australia. They came here from elsewhere. And so I think now when we talk about the notion that they don't have a right to move, you can say what you want. You can, fall in love with whom you want. You can believe or not believe in the religion you want. But you can't leave the country you're in if you're threatened with murder and genocide. Strikes me as unsustainable.
Except there is a counter unsustainability argument, isn't there, Mohsin? And that is that if there is total free movement and if there is no functional system by which to regulate that movement, then what you end up with is a series of societies, probably wealthier societies, that simply cannot bear the demand. And so that in itself becomes completely unsustainable.
Yeah, I think that's right, that there's two things that we're trying to balance in my mind. One is, I do believe there's a human right to move. But the second is, I believe there's legitimate fear on the part of people who live in societies that people are moving to, of being swamped, of being, in a society that changes too fast. And what we have to find is a way of navigating this tension where we respect the idea that people are concerned and frightened about movement into their societies. But we also respect what I think is the right to move and find some kind of balance between those two things.
Let me just take you up on that, because, I mean, in your description of, now we move freely across borders. Once upon a time, there were no borders. But, of course, there were other things. There were communities that were, in relative degrees, homogenous. There were certain cultural and traditional lines of relationship. There were things, in other words, that actually solidified a sense of local identity.
Well, in fact, Scott, just to embellish that, wouldn't you say that those local identities and those social groupings you're talking about were more organic than the ones that we have today in the form of the nation state, and as a result, disruption would be even more significant?
Well, yes, absolutely. But I think one of the things that I'm not I'm not suggesting we need to go back to anything, but one of the things that those smaller communities did in fact have is mechanisms of regulation, of absorption, because things were oftentimes undergirt by some sense of reciprocity, by some sense of generosity. And I just wonder, you know, it really strikes me what you were saying, Mohsin, because so often the way that we carry on these terms of debate, either it's completely open borders come what may, or anybody who expresses some concern about local disruptions is by definition, okay, a UKIP racist or a bigot or an unreconstructed whatever. I mean, you know, it strikes me that already there's a kind of withering away of our capacity to be able to talk about difference and identity in a way that is constructive.
I think it's useful to start by thinking of, you know, what are the things that unite us? And to a certain extent, I believe that everybody is a migrant. Because, of course, there's migration across geographies. You can come from a place like Pakistan to a place like Australia, as I did by airplane a couple of days ago. But there's also migration across time. So, you know, the old man who's 90 years old and lives in Sydney in the same neighborhood that he grew up in is really, in a way, a foreigner to the current Sydney that perhaps is around him. The city has changed enormously. And that person has encountered something that feels much like a migration. And so I think that if we think of time and people moving through time, what we discover is that migration is sort of a universal human phenomenon. And for me, what that means is what we're talking about is also people who are resisting geographic migration. Partly what they're talking about is they don't want to arrive in a future, migrate to a future, which is so unwelcoming and frightening that they wouldn't want to inhabit it.
And is there a relationship between the migration of peoples, perhaps the irregular migration of peoples, and the migration towards an unwelcome future?
I think there is. And so for me, what it comes down to is, let's look a couple centuries into the future. And perhaps we could look back a couple centuries into the past and say, well, you know, a couple centuries ago, there was no country called Australia. There was no country called Pakistan. The United States was just barely born. And two centuries hence, it's quite plausible that these countries won't exist either, and that we might have a very different, more mongrelized, more, you could say, mixed world than we have today. And if that's likely, in a way, what we need to do now is to say, how do we build, starting today, the steps that will take us to that world of two centuries hence in a way that we feel, you know, won't frighten us, that we can be excited about? Because it's worth bearing in mind that societies like Australia, like America, and if you think the societies are wonderful and beautiful and have achieved great things, which in many ways they are and have, these societies are built on migration. So is there a way to build towards a future society that actually isn't frightening like this, but is a, you know, amazing future Australia or future America that one's great-great-grandchildren would be lucky and excited to live in?
Can I lay out to the two of you what I suspect here is the two sides of a kind of paradox that we seem to be stuck in. On the one hand, I worry that oftentimes kind of, let's call them, say, liberal intellectuals or middle-class liberals who advocate much freer, much more open border controls. Oftentimes, there is a kind of reluctance to admit to the fact that they themselves will not need to come in contact with the very people that they are welcoming to these shores. In other words, there's a kind of denial of the cost being played by the indigenous poor, by the local poor. On the flip side, there is another kind of moral paradox, which is the very people who are advocating strong borders, who want to try to regulate immigration flows, at exactly the same time are refusing to countenance serious international action on climate change and refusal to acknowledge the people that that will most affect, and at the same time are also refusing to honor international obligations when it comes to the mitigation of those who live in the poor countries of this world. And in other words, it seems to me that we're actually on two, you know, the only options that we really have left are two sides of both lose-lose situations.
Well, yeah, I think that's an interesting idea, but there is a philosophical consistency to the latter group that you talk about, isn't there, Scott? Which is that it's an overt, it has embedded within it a worldview that is overtly nationalist. that says that we have a nation that we control and that we can conceive of the world of different parcels of land around which there are borders that are coherently in control of their respective parcels. And whether that be economic or whether it be environmental or whatever, when you talk about not wanting to engage in climate change mitigation, for example, that is an inherently globalist idea. And these are people who are coming clearly from a position that does not have globalist concern. It's simply not part of the political map or the human map that they have in their mind. Am I overstating that?
Well, no, I mean, there's a logical consistency, but only insofar as it goes. I mean, the only way, it seems to me, of making a strong case for the need to preserve forms of local identity, the only way of actually making that case on morally sound grounds is to say that the effect on the poorest countries of the world of mass, especially mass skilled migration, is going to be incalculable. That those who are left behind will most often be in a worse situation than they were before. The only way of making the moral case is by saying we will therefore redouble our efforts to make sure that this vast chasm, this vast chasm between the wealthy and the poor that is currently, I mean, this is the great moral sin of our generation, it seems to me. The only way of actually making that case morally is by addressing something on some kind of international scale. Apart from that, it's just morally indefensible.
Morrison.
Well, I think that, you know, when we start talking about people as the countries they belong to, like what will happen to Myanmar or to Indonesia or to Somalia if X, Y, or Z occurs, and we begin to lump people into these nations, I think that does a disservice to people. I mean, I believe in human beings and I understand the existence of countries, but I think when we look at how human beings are choosing to live, they might choose to leave their countries. They might choose not to be of their country in the same way that we wouldn't expect them to cling to a religion or cling to some other kind of worldview. I don't think we should necessarily say that they should cling to their nationality or to their nation, that the skilled migration of people harms the nation, so therefore those skilled migrants shouldn't be allowed to leave, in the same way that perhaps the loss of, you know, hardworking people might harm a religion and make it a less, you know, effective group of people. But aside from that, one other thing that I would like to add into this is we're already seeing enormous migration into our cities. It doesn't matter, you know, what country you live in, but people are moving to cities. And in these giant cities that are being born. So in Pakistan, for example, you know, there'll probably be 50 or 60 million people moving to large cities in the next 10, 20 years. Across Asia, 1 billion people are doing it every decade or two. That scale of migration is much, much bigger than the migration, you know, to wealthy countries. And it's happening for similar reasons. In cities are coming into existence more attractive societies. And when you build an attractive society, you shouldn't be surprised if it attracts people. And so I think part of what we need to do is to think of the creation of attractive societies across the world, not just in wealthy countries, but also in cities that can be beacons for people, in the way that Lahore, the city I live in Pakistan, is for people. Many minorities who would feel persecuted, religious minorities like Christians in Pakistan, choose to settle in cities like Lahore because there is more tolerance there. So I think what we're looking at is actually a much more nuanced and global kind of migration. It's not only an international movement. It's many other kinds of movement as well.
Here in the Minefield with Scott Stevens and Waleed Ali, our guest is Mohsin Hamid, who's a Pakistani writer. He has several books, including The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which you might recall was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. He has a new collection of essays and reviews called Discontent and Its Civilizations, and we're talking about this problem of mass migration in a world where people or countries are erecting borders. Mohsin, you seem to be talking there really about a phenomenon of identity and how we understand this. But the rationales that we identified at the start, I wonder if we can come in the handful of minutes we have left to those. The idea that we have humanitarian reasons for erecting brutal border control regimes. So we are so concerned with lives being lost at sea and people making the decision to get on dangerous boats that we will do even quite violent things to people in the name of protecting them. Does this rationale make sense?
I don't think so. I mean, I think if we are honest with ourselves, I can accept the idea that people say, look, Australia is the way it is, and the arrival of large numbers of migrants will change that, and we don't want it to change. I think that's a perfectly understandable point of view. The point of view that we must stop these migrants from migrating to protect them, I don't think is particularly valid. But what I would say is the first point, I think, is valid. And if one were to say, you know, how would you construct an Australia that could take large numbers of migrants, perhaps educate them, train them, integrate them in a way that maybe Australia over the years and decades and centuries might have a slightly different skin tone than it does today, but still retain a lot of the feeling and essence of what Australian society is at this moment. I think that's something which might well be possible and which we haven't really dedicated much time as societies to thinking about how to do.
But what if my concern isn't that? My concern is not I'm worried about what Australia will become. I'm honestly just saying to you, I just don't want to see people dying anymore at sea.
Well, I think that it's not going to stop. What's going to happen is these movements are going to increase. Climate change, war, famine, the direction of human movement is going to increase. We have a huge and, you know, incredibly densely populated world, and we're going to see the failures of different ecosystems, the failure of different political systems. If water levels rise, for example, in Bangladesh significantly, and if Bangladesh is unable to build tidal defenses, you have 200 million Bangladeshis who will be exposed to flooding. And, you know, the kind of mass movement that could come out of that is just enormous. So what we're going to see is incredible pressures on people to move, and protecting these people by saying, no, look, you know, so what if your country's underwater? We just want to make you safe. Please stay in your flooded country. Or so what if in your country, you know, another ethnic group is trying to butcher you in your millions? Please stay, because we don't want you to risk the voyage. I don't think that's a sustainable argument.
I think this is one of the great moral problems, by the way, with talking about the people trading movement in economic terms. I mean, actually, it sterilizes it and makes certain forms of response, let's just say, far more politically and morally defensible than it otherwise would have been. Mohsin, I do want to come to just sort of one last matter, though, of international obligation. I mean, one of the very scary things, it seems to me, is that at this moment, the responsibility for relocating, for resituating people who are fleeing intolerable zones, who are genuine migrants, in other words, that responsibility is currently falling on those nations that absolutely are least able to bear it. I mean, how do you see this situation?
Well, I think that you're right. It is falling upon often very poor countries that are themselves, struggling to take care of their own people. But for me, it's the beginning of a process where I think countries are going to be less important in the future. Already at an economic level, at the financial level, even at the level of human movement, countries are being overwhelmed in a way. You know, the rise of the nation state occurred in a particular moment of the 1900s, late 1800s. We didn't have nation states before. I think that there's a good likelihood that the nation state won't stay in its current form in the future, because so many nation states are proving inadequate to the tasks that we expect them to abide by. And so other kinds of organizations, be they global or regional or just networks of people coming together across the nation state, will have to rise up to take some of this load.
But does this mean
this is
that
terrible news for Radio National, can I say, Scott?
That's right. I should say, I mean, does this mean, though, that there's going to be more moral importance on international obligations, on international organizations, or does it mean that more local communities are going to end up being more morally significant?
Well, I don't have an answer for you, but my own instinct is, and my own preference is, I mean, I think that we hopefully will see two different things happening. One is something at the level of the human, where similar rights apply to people everywhere, where we come together to solve problems globally. And the second one is a reinforcement of people's power at the very local level, which isn't the nation state necessarily. It could be the neighborhood. Even within Australia, there must be many neighbourhoods and regions and small communities who would like more control over how their local community functions. And all over the world, what we're seeing is the nation state has gobbled up all this stuff. It's gobbled stuff from the human collective, and it's gobbled stuff from the local community. I'd like to see both of those things start to move away from the nation state.
So perhaps it retains its meanings by erecting borders and continuing the discourse, at least, of the nation state. No, that's, anyway, it's a very interesting idea of glocalisation that you raised there, Mawson. Unfortunately, we can't explore it any further at this point. It's been a privilege to have you on the show. Thank you so much for dropping by, and enjoy your time in Australia.
Thank you very much.
To the extent Australia exists, of course. Mohsen Hamid, Pakistani writer. His books include The Reluctant Fundamentalist, and his most recent is Discontent and Its Civilizations, joining us on The Minefield.
Yes, and if you'd like to leave a comment, you can tweet us at RNTheMinefield.
We will see you next week, all being well.
Did you know, now you can watch ABC TV anytime, anywhere, on iView.
Here we go.
Here we go.
So this summer, whether you're at home by the pool, travelling, or camping under the stars, if you've got the internet, you can watch ABC TV now on iView.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah?
Olé!
Arriba!
Always with you, always iView. Available on your computer, tablet, or smartphone.